Welcome to the North Carolina Reading Service. Today is Monday, May the 5th. Broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, we bring news and information from around the world, country, state, and triangle to listeners who are blind and print impaired. Our broadcasts are received from Wilmington to Winston-Salem over specially tuned radio receivers and via the internet at www.ncreadingservice.org. All news is read as printed. Our first hour covers news, editorials, and comments of statewide interest. Your readers are
Dick Hayden
and Judith Dykstar. And we'll begin with the front page and weather, followed by articles of statewide interest. First up, the weather. And according to AccuWeather, today is going to be a high of 81 degrees and a possible thunderstorm in the afternoon, so eye to the sky. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a real feel of 56, same as the predicted temperature. For Tuesday, partly sunny and pleasant with a high of 79 and a low of 55. And then on Wednesday, partly sunny and pleasant with a high of 81 and a low of 59. In today's News and Observer, we have four front-page articles. The first is Topsail residents blocked Pendo founders' plans to develop. And then we have police say this is how to deal with unsafe drivers. Also, Raleigh hauls away scrap art creation after complaints. And then the final one is UNC basketball player High, and that is the player's name, suspended for sexual misconduct. Above the banner in today's paper in the sports section, Aho's latest goal in double overtime adds to his clutch history. And our noon readers will be telling you more about that when they come on the air at noon. First front page article today, I will be reading this one. And the headline reads, Topsail residents blocked Pendo founders' plans to develop. Here's an update. Real estate news. Topsail residents had already stopped one of Raleigh's most prominent multimillionaires from building on the last remaining tract of undeveloped land in town. They finally got the last word. With the support of almost 800 donors, the NC Coastal Land Trust closed on what locals call the Point, about 150 acres of pristine coastline at One Shoreline Drive in Pender County. To fund the purchase, the trust raised close to $8 million, including $1.6 million, from individual donations and the remainder from state and federal grant programs, including the NC Land and Water Fund and U.S. Fish and Wildlife. As part of the transaction, a one-acre portion of the site, including the existing parking area and surrounding land, was sold to the town of Topsail Beach. This is a once-in-a-generation conservation victory, Trust Executive Director Harrison Marks said in an April 29th email to members. Since 2008, the McLeod family had owned the property. It's valued at $2.96 million, according to latest county records. In November 2023, Pendo CEO Todd Olson scrapped plans to purchase the property after failing to secure rezoning approval that would allow him to build a family compound. Despite strong public pushback, he wanted to build a private estate for his family on 30 acres on the island's southernmost tip, which is currently zoned conservation. In exchange, he promised to permanently conserve the remaining 120 acres with the North Carolina Coastal Land Trust using his own private funds. He cited the town's lack of collaboration for pulling out of the deal. The trust secured a bridge loan to meet the closing deadline. It now plans to hold the property for up to a year, Eric Vreeland, the trust's director of strategic advancement, told the NNO. Once grants are received, it will transfer the property to the state, be managed by the NC Department of Environmental Quality's Division of Coastal Management. In recent months, the Trump administration has enacted freezes on various grants related to U.S. wildlife conservation. Vreeland said the trust federal funding has already been approved, but admitted a slight question mark remains. Even so, he remains positive. The point has been purchased and protected, he said. People stepped up, not just from the local community, but from the Triangle as well. People who have family here or second homes. Because of that, it got done. Dick.
Thank you, Judy.
Because of the sensitivity of the discussions, declined to describe President Trump's view of the decision to transfer more Patriot systems to Ukraine. The White House's National Security Council does not provide details on the strength and placement of defense systems, said James Hewitt, a spokesperson for the council. President Trump has been clear. He wants the war in Ukraine to end and the killing to stop, he said. A former White House official said that the Biden administration had secured the agreement with Israel in September before the election won by Trump. The Defense Department said in a statement that it continues to provide equipment to Ukraine from previously authorized packages, referring to weaponry pulled from existing inventories and new purchases. The delivery, which has not been previously reported, comes as Russia has stepped up its attacks on Ukraine, including an April 24th missile strike on Kyiv, the capital, that was the deadliest since last summer. A year ago, allies struggled to answer a demand for Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky for 7 Patriot systems. Although Ukraine now has 8, only 6 are functioning. The other 2 are being refurbished, one of the U.S. officials said. With the 1 from Israel and 1 from Germany or Greece, Ukraine would have 10 Patriot systems in total, largely to protect Kyiv. As Russia has intensified recent attacks, Trump's recent public remarks on the war have softened in favor of Ukraine. Trump had a cordial meeting with Zelensky at Pope Francis's funeral in Rome last week. After a disastrous one in February in the White House, he dialed down the negative rhetoric about Zelensky and questioned whether Russia is seriously considering peace. A delayed minerals deal with Ukraine was signed on Wednesday, paving the way for U.S. military aid. On Saturday, Zelensky told reporters in Kyiv that the minerals deal...
Thank you, Dick. And this front page article is authored by Josh Schaefer of the NNO, and the headline reads, Eyesore or Art? Raleigh hauls away scrap creation after neighbors' complaints. For at least a decade, the house at 1602 Oakwood Avenue stood surrounded by an 8-foot wall of white lattice, hung with antique mirrors, a rainbow pinwheel, a Batman cape, and a choir of ceramic angels, all daring anyone to ignore the spectacle. Depending on your taste, the Southeast Raleigh landmark qualified either as the world's most eccentric trinket collection or a prize-winning pile of junk. On special mornings, you'd see the artist himself sweeping the sidewalk out front while curious commuters drove past, startled out of their ordinary Tuesdays. But on the Friday before last, the city ruled decisively in favor of the junk faction, hauling it away as a public nuisance. The scrapyard art creation had drawn 3 complaints in the last 6 months, and it blocked the sidewalk, having at least partially collapsed. City spokeswoman Julia Milstead said Raleigh offered chances to move some of the stuff. At the end of the day, she said, this boiled down to a safety issue. A St. Augustine's University neighbor. But neighbors on the streets around St. Augustine's University see a sinister lack of tolerance and willingness to coexist in a part of Raleigh that has seen the old and crumbling rapidly replaced by the new and expensive. As the wall at 1602 Oakwood grew higher, adding a carousel horse and a Starbucks umbrella, a steady migration of newcomers arrived in far larger houses, sparking a tear-down trend that ruffles the old-timers' feathers. Having participated in this migration, albeit 20 years ago, I stand as a witness to how quickly the definition of eyesore can change. So around the Oakwood Avenue house, the faithful lament a familiar loss of character. R.I.P. to a true Raleigh landmark, said a disappointed fan on an Instagram post from Raleigh downtown. This is what it is to watch a living city die. Don't move into a historical neighborhood and demand that its quirkiness leave, echoed a post from Nail Yay, a salon down nearby Hill Street. The city hasn't been concerned about the neighborhood until this new wave of people started moving in. Ken's Smell Goods. I knocked on the door of 1602 Oakwood four times last week and never got an answer, even though the occupant and artist were clearly at home to hear the knocking. I'm guessing he didn't feel like speaking to anybody else wearing an ID badge on a lanyard. So I walked around the corner onto Hill Street and found Ken Evans, who owns and operates a business called Ken's Smell Goods and Fashionware. As you might guess, Evans sells both fragrances and secondhand clothing. Before he operated the store, he drove a truck for Macy's, and he would buy all the damaged boxes of clothes at a discount. Nobody in this neighborhood cares, he told me, if a North Face jacket or a pair of Nikes comes in a banged-up box. As to the junkyard around the corner, he and his longtime neighbors are steaming. Blocking the sidewalk? Then they should have pushed it, Evans said. It looked like Fred Sanford over there. That's how I told people to find my store. People complained? Maybe one or two complained, he said, but that didn't trump the whole neighborhood. That don't trump what's been there 20 years. He had stuff you and I can't get no more. Captain America, Superman, Big Wheels. I told him, you got the last Big Wheel. Members only jackets. I told him, you're the last member. Rant warning. As a migrant myself, I deeply understand the appeal of life around downtown. Restaurants and bars in walking distance, historic houses with plaques out front, neighbors that vary by age, race, income status, and tendency to tell long stories while you've got an armful of groceries. But this place isn't for everybody. A lot of people around here drive rusted pickup trucks with junk in the back, and they might park them near your house. On some evenings, a stranger might knock on your door and tell you he's homeless, then offer to weed your garden for cash. Inconceivable as it may sound, I've seen people hang their wash on a clothesline. Honestly, I can recall a few moments when I thought of ratting somebody out on See, Click, Fix, or even worse, that gathering of paranoid outrage addicts who inhabit next door. But I always stop myself, not wanting to be that guy, not wanting to live on that street. Dick.
Thank you, Judith. Next up, UNC basketball player Zayden High, suspended for sexual misconduct, kept team perks. It's a very long article, and we've had to condense it because of time constraints, but I think we can bring the essence of it available to you. UNC Chapel Hill suspended men's basketball player Zayden High from university last semester after finding he violated the campus policy on sexual exploitation, according to documents and correspondence reviewed by the NNO and interviews of those involved. High is a 6'9" power forward from Spring Branch, Texas. He was a four-star recruit of the class of 2023. He joined UNC on a scholarship player, quickly making an impression in a promising player and enthusiastic bench presence. High filled another student without the student's consent during a sexual encounter between them last year, the student told the NNO. The NNO confirmed the student's account of the incident through additional interviews with five people who had knowledge of the situation. The student felt validated and relieved when UNC's Equal Opportunity and Compliance Office found High responsible for violating the university's policy on sexual misconduct in late August. Not that it made my pain from what happened go away, but it did make me feel like he was being held accountable, the student said. But in months since the university issued its findings, the student said she has become increasingly concerned that the university has not ensured that High adequately followed the sanctions imposed upon him. After serving a one-semester suspension in the fall, in which he was not allowed to be enrolled as a student at the university or participate in athletics, High re-enrolled at the university this spring while remaining on probation for at least the duration of the semester. Per the terms of the sanctions issued to High by the EOC office for his misconduct, he is barred from representing the university in any way, including by participating in athletics while on probation. But during the probationary period, High has retained several perks that accompany being an athlete at the university, according to university correspondence about the issue reviewed by the NNO. That includes access to athletic facilities, where High has been allowed to practice on his own and receive athlete meals and other services. High was also around several members of the basketball team on the court of the Dean E. Smith Center on at least one occasion while he was on probation, according to video evidence. It's extremely frustrating, to say the least, the student said. The student did not press criminal charges against High, choosing instead to report the incident to the EOC office in an effort to retain her privacy, given that her identity may have become public through a police report or other legal documents. Spokespeople for the university and the athletic department did not answer questions from the NNO about the investigation into High, instead providing a one-sentence statement. The university also provided answers to general questions about standard rules for disciplinary procedures and processes involving students. Under a 2020 state Supreme Court ruling against UNC, public universities in North Carolina are required, if such information is requested, to release the names of students who are found to have violated university policies on sexual misconduct, as well as the violation the student committed and any sanctions imposed by the university on that student. A lawyer who represents media outlets, including the Daily Tar Heel and McClatchy newspapers, in the case of High, said High's records would likely be subject to disclosure under that ruling. But the university denied the NNO's request for the documents related to the investigation into High's misconduct, citing State Public Records Act and Federal Educational Rights and Privacy Act, or FERPA. The university said that in a statement, it complies with the 2020 ruling but did not explain why High's records would not be subject to disclosure under the ruling. We fully comply with federal policy privacy law and the 2020 North Carolina Supreme Court case DTH versus Folt when sharing information about whether any student is subject to an academic or disciplinary process, a statement from the university read. The unnamed student's lawyer provided the NNO with key portions of the final notice of the investigation's findings. While that notice does not specifically name High, additional documentation and correspondence viewed by the NNO, as well as interviews about the situation, confirm that High was the unnamed responding party referenced in the document. Sam Coleman, a Hillsborough attorney who represented High at the EOC proceedings, did not respond to multiple phone calls and text messages from the NNO over a week-long program. Within days of returning to campus, the student decided to report a filming incident to the EOC. In doing so, she hoped to hold High accountable for his actions, but to protect her identity, particularly given that High's membership on the university's basketball team could have led to a police report or other legal proceedings against him, garnering significant attention from the media and the public. The EOC opened an investigation interviewing the student, her hallmate and friend, as well as High and witnesses who spoke to his account of the incident. The student said transcripts she reviewed of High's interview showed he contradicted her version of the events at multiple points, but she provided additional evidence to investigators that further supported her account. In a statement to investigators, she expressed concerns about High's testimony. Based on the investigation, officials eventually found that High was responsible for sexual exploitation, a violation of the university's broader policy on prohibited discrimination, harassment, and related misconduct. The student and Sky David, the student's attorney, told the NNO that High appealed the sanctions twice. Both appeals were unsuccessful, and the EOC's recommendation stood. On August 26, 2024, the EOC issued its final notice of the investigation, including several sanctions beginning with an indefinite suspension of at least one full semester, during which High could not be enrolled as a student. Classes for the fall semester had been in session for a week at the time of that final notice, making it unclear whether the EOC enforced the stipulation that High serve a, quote, full, end quote, semester suspension. The sanctions indicated that High could choose to enroll again after his suspension, assuming he fulfilled his sanctions and his application for readmission was approved. Disciplinary suspension terminates the responding party's relationship with the university under conditions that both permit and anticipate his return to the university, the notice read. If High re-enrolled at the university, according to the notice, he would be required to remain under probation for at least one additional semester, and during that time would be banned from participating in any activity in which he represents the university, including athletics or other competitive teams, and from participating in any university-recognized student organizations either within or outside the university community. High was also required to satisfy an educational requirement in which he was to complete an approved course of instruction or counseling that addresses consent, sexual exploitation, and healthy relationships, and meet with an EOC official to discuss the university's policy on discrimination and harassment, among other mandates. His sanctions also required him to permanently delete any recordings or photos of the student on his phone or other devices. Judith?
Thank you, Dick. And this next article has a headline, nearly 1 million Americans face losing health insurance as Aetna exits ACA marketplace. Nearly a million people in 17 states face losing health care coverage after Aetna's parent company announced it would leave the federal insurance marketplace created under the Affordable Care Act during the Obama administration. Aetna, along with various other health care and insurance companies, is owned and operated by the pharmacy giant CVS, which announced Aetna's withdrawal from the ACA despite surpassing financial expectations. ACA tax credits and other financial incentives implemented by the Biden administration in 2021 are scheduled to expire next year, leading to higher premium costs for people who enroll through the federal health care marketplace. The end of the credits is partly what led to CVS's decision to remove Aetna as an option through the ACA. The credits led to record enrollment in ACA programs this year of nearly 24 million people, Forbes reported. CVS said Aetna is not a major player in the ACA marketplace compared with other health insurance plans, and added that it will still offer other options. The company is best able to serve members through its other health benefit solutions, which offer access to quality care, affordable health benefits, and exceptional service, CVS said in a statement. The company will continue delivering superior service and support to its individual exchange members through 2025 and residual activities in 2026, it continued. This is not the first time Aetna has been removed from the marketplace. It was unavailable in 2017 and 2018, but returned in 2021. Dick?
Thank you, Judith. Next up from the NNO, Trump's funding cuts to NPR, PBS threatens NC stations. Big Bird, Cookie Monster, Snuffleupagus found themselves the latest victims of President Trump's executive orders. Late Thursday night, Trump instructed the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to cease funding to NPR and PBS. at risk is $535 million provided annually to around 1,600 radio and television stations across the country, an earmark in the most recent congressional budget set the CPB's funding levels through 2027. The executive order emulates Trump's recent attacks on members of the media, including banning the Associated Press from the Oval Office, suing CBS, and shuttering Voice of America. It's not yet clear how the executive order will be carried out, but the results will likely have a direct impact on the 12 PBS television stations and 9 NPR stations in North Carolina. Those include Durham's WUNC and Charlotte's WFAE, where reporters from the NNO appear as regular guests on shows like Due South and Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins. Paul Hunton, UNC's president and general manager, learned of the executive order around 11:45 p.m. Thursday. WUNC receives $800,000 in federal money annually. In North Carolina, it would have a big effect, Hunton told McClatchy. We've got 9 stations that cover most of the state, and that's a lot of investment in infrastructure and technology. We've got one of the bigger newsrooms in the area. He added that Trump's executive order would challenge our ability to bring our audience national programming, because the executive order states the federal funding cannot be spent directly or indirectly on NPR programming. Hunton was elected to the NPR Board of Directors on Friday. David Crabtree, CEO and General Manager of PBS North Carolina, echoed Hunton's concerns on the impact in the state. PBS North Carolina has been on the air for more than 70 years. While this is framed as defunding PBS at the national level, it directly threatens vital funding for local stations, Crabtree said in a written statement. Federal support accounts for $4.8 million of our annual operating budget. This funding is critical to the essential services we provide every day, such as delivering emergency communications across the state, educational programming and resources, and the local and national programs our viewers depend upon. Crabtree said he is actively monitoring develops at the station that would remain steadfast in our mission to educate, inform, and inspire. On Thursday, Trump accused NPR and PBS of receiving tens of millions of dollars in taxpayer funding to spread radical, woke propaganda disguised as news. PBS website states that 15% of the network's revenue comes from federal funding, and both PBS and NPR hold fundraising drives for additional money from supporters. UNC ended its drive on Thursday.
Thank you, Dick. And this article has a headline, Patriot Defense System Headed for Ukraine as Ceasefire Hopes Dim. An Israel-based Patriot air defense system is being moved to Ukraine to help in its ongoing battle against a three-year-long Russian invasion, officials announced Sunday. The system will be sent after it is refurbished, and Western allies have said Germany and Greece could also send an additional one. The deployment of the Patriot system is a continuation of the previous administration's commitment to send more defense weapons to Kyiv. In September, former President Joe Biden arranged a deal with Israel to send the missile defense system to Ukraine before Donald Trump was reelected. Trump administration officials said it continues to provide equipment to Ukraine from previously authorized agreements, the New York Times reported. The Trump administration has said in recent weeks that it wants an end to the war in Ukraine, but the chances of a quick resolution have taken a hit in recent weeks after Russian President Vladimir Putin launched a drone attack on key Ukrainian infrastructure on the eve of a proposed ceasefire. Kyiv media reported that 4 people have been killed and at least 30 more injured in a barrage of drone attacks in recent days, including 11 children. Air defenses shot down 69 drones while 80 vanished from radars, likely used as decoys to overwhelm Ukraine's defenses, the Kyiv Independent reported. The assault was countered with electronic warfare units, aviation, anti-aircraft missile systems, and mobile fire groups. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has said a real ceasefire is necessary to bring the war to an end. Russia is calling for a ceasefire on May 9th, The Independent reported. The purpose of the North Carolina Reading Service is to connect people who are blind and print impaired to each other and the community by delivering news, information, and entertainment using the latest audio technology. To receive more information, please visit our website at www.ncreadingservice.org or call us at 919-832-5138. Once more, that number is 919-832-5138. We're now going to switch over to the opinion section of today's News and Observer, and I have the first article with the headline, North Carolina's Most Powerful Politicians Now Has Something to Prove. And the author is Andrew Dunn, who is a contributing columnist to the Charlotte Observer and the News Observer of Raleigh. And he writes, one after another, State Senator Phil Berger has started rolling out endorsements from allies old and new. Agriculture Commissioner Steve Troxler, State Auditor Dave Bolick, the sheriff from Alamance County, even former legislators. All standard fare in campaign season, but it's May of an odd-numbered year. The next General Assembly election is still 10 months away. Ordinarily, this is time for legislation and budget negotiations, not public campaigning, but Berger isn't treating this like a typical off-year. He's not acting like the politician who has coasted through re-election after re-election without breaking a sweat. He's acting like someone with something to prove. And that's because, for the first time in a long time, Phil Berger has a real race on his hands. Since first winning his Senate seat in 2000, Berger has rarely faced serious opposition. That freedom has given him space not just to legislate, but to build. Today, he doesn't just lead the Senate. He sets the agenda for the legislature, controls the campaign dollars, that power swing seat Republicans, and directs a political machine that touches nearly every major decision in state government. When a bill gets written, a judge gets picked, or a council of state seat opens up. Berger is involved, often decisively. But that long stretch without competition may have come at a cost. While Berger was shaping the state to his liking, his ties to his home turf in Rockingham County began to fray. Now, for the first time in more than a decade, he's being forced to look back. This year's challenge comes from Sheriff Sam Page, a fellow Republican with deep local roots and a sizable following among conservatives. Page has served as Rockingham County Sheriff since 1998, cultivating a reputation as a tough-on-crime, pro-Trump lawman who never shied away from a fight. He considered challenging Berger in 2024, but stepped aside and instead launched a run for lieutenant governor. He didn't come close statewide, but in Rockingham County, he dominated. That's not new. In 2014, Berger won 59% of the county vote. Page, on the same ballot, earned 76%. A flawed but telling 2023 poll showed Page starting a primary race with a lead. The warning signs haven't stopped. Last year, Berger's son Kevin, a county commissioner and close political ally, barely survived a primary challenge, winning by just 3 votes. Voters in Rockingham know both men well, and in a political climate growing more hostile to entrenched power, Page may offer the contrast local Republicans didn't know they wanted until now. Over the years, Berger's influence has become more than legislative. Through appointments, budgets, and legal power, the Berger family has embedded itself in nearly every layer of government, all anchored in a single rural district. But that level of reach creates distance, and in 2023, the cracks started to show. Berger backed a plan to bring casino gambling to 4 locations across North Carolina, including a site in Rockingham County. The response was immediate. Residents packed public meetings. Lawsuits followed. Political allies became critics. Page emerged as one of the plan's most vocal opponents. Even supporters of the idea expressed frustration with the process, opaque, rushed, and largely detached from local input. It was a rare public misstep for a politician known for always being two moves ahead, and it deepened a perception that had been building for years. Berger was no longer the small-town lawyer from Eden, but a Raleigh power broker who'd lost touch with the voters who sent him there. Berger isn't behaving like someone expecting a sleepy primary. The early endorsements, new email newsletters, a spike in sponsored legislation. It's the kind of retail politics he hasn't needed in years, maybe decades. And when Page suggested Berger might try to revive the gambling bill this session, the pushback came swiftly. Unlike Sam Page, Senator Berger is neither a liar nor a political opportunist, Berger's campaign spokesman told the News and Observer in February. And unlike Sam Page, when Senator Berger says something, voters can believe it. That's not a quote you give when you're feeling confident. The old rule in politics still holds. If you're not worried, you ignore the criticism. If you are, you punch back. Berger still holds every advantage that matters, the fundraising network, institutional loyalty, and the tools of legislative power. But this time, that may not be enough. To keep his seat, he'll have to campaign like he means it and like he remembers what it feels like to fight for votes, because this time, the outcome isn't guaranteed. Dick.
Our second commentary comes from Lou DeCock of the NNO. Excuse me. Mr. DeCock's article is titled, Bad Blood, Canes and Caps Have Reasons to Hate Each Other. The Washington Capitals all but put a bounty on Jalen Chatfield's head before their final meeting with the Carolina Hurricanes of the regular season 3 weeks ago, albeit minus any radio interview labeling him as the, quote, chief punk, end quote. 9 days earlier at the Lenovo Center, Chatfield ended a fight, one of many altercations and flashpoints in a game with 142 penalty minutes, with Connor McMichael with a wrestling-style takedown. And the Capitals didn't like it because McMichael had lost his helmet earlier in the fisticuffs. In the return match in Washington, Capitals winger Brandon Duhaime sought out Chatfield and challenged him to a fight 6 minutes into the game. By the logic of the hockey code, archaic as it may be, that should have settled all scores. But with the Hurricanes and the Capitals on a collision course ever since, their second-round matchup again raises the eternal question of whether bad blood from the regular season carries over into the postseason. Everyone always insists that it does not, because the stakes are so much higher. But they may be right. Then again, these are two teams that hate each other, always have, for the better part of three decades. It may not be about settling scores. It may be about opening new accounts. It's playoff hockey, and you want to win, so you have to be smart when you go out there, Hurricane center Jesperi Kotkaniemi said. If they want to go into the box, we'll play power play for sure. They always play hard. They've got a little tougher team, big boys there. They try to battle hard. I think that's been working for them. The series will start in Washington with the Capitals looking to rev up their fans and themselves after a lukewarm first-round win over the Montreal Canadiens, which means that Tom Wilson will most certainly be looking for the big hit that can change a game or even a series, just as he did on Montreal's Alexander Carrière in the first round. Logan Stankoven and Jakson Blake better be on their toes. At least, unlike 2019, neck-breaker Brooks Orpik isn't still around. But 12 players from that epic seven-game series are, including both Andrei Shchenyukov and Alex Ovechkin, the latter knocking out the former in a fight that felt like some twisted rookie initiation that also inaugurated the return of postseason hockey to Raleigh after a decade-long drought. Two of the 12 have even switched sides in the interim, defenseman Dmitry Orlov and Trevor Van Roomsdyk. Game 7 was crazy, Orloff said. Washington, we started with a good game, up 2-0, 3-1, something like that. Then just something happened. Sometimes, if you look back, some series, some hockey games, in the third period when you try to save the score, you stop playing and just try to defend. The Hurricanes took advantage to cut short Washington's Stanley Cup defense. Jordan Staal tied the score with 3 minutes to go before Brock McGinn finished the job in the second overtime. The rest is history. Ironically, the most damaging hit of that series, Ovechkin's right hand notwithstanding, was delivered by Hurricanes' Warren Fogle. Not exactly a noted enforcer. He sent T.J. Oshie into the boards just as Oshie lost his footing, a relatively benign hit with severe consequences that knocked Oshie out of the series with a broken collarbone. Which is a good reminder that the playoffs are often rough and tumble, whether the teams like each other or not. That strange heroes and villains can emerge, and that even if the regular season series between the Caps and the Canes had been entirely uneventful, this playoff match was always unlikely to be. The Hurricanes are better equipped for it than they were in 2019, having learned difficult lessons about postseason discipline in the interim, and bulking up this season with a big, willing bowling ball forwards like Eric Robinson, 6'2", William Carrier, 6'2", Mark Jankowski, 6'4", not to mention a top of his game Mishezhnikov, who is always a threat to level somebody. The enmity between these franchises was born in the Southeast Division and boiled to the surface in 2019 when they finally played for something that mattered. That's not likely to change now, no matter what happened in April. Judith?
Thank you, Dick. And this next article is a commentary by Matt Hughes. Matt Hughes has been a commissioner for the town of Hillsboro since 2018 and is a member of the steering committee for the Center for New Liberalism. The headline reads, NC Town Commissioner, we need to rethink housing codes to make ownership attainable. And Mr. Hughes writes, the Orange County Tax Assessor's Office recently sent out property revaluation notices, sparking the usual debate over methodology and accuracy. But this year's average increase of 49.5%, with many homeowners seeking spikes over 100%, underscores a bigger issue. We still have no real plan for housing affordability, or as I like to describe it, housing attainability. Our community hasn't made the tough calls needed to modernize land use policies or expand housing supply. We often act as if the usual economic rules don't apply here, but they do, and with detrimental effect. The core drivers of rising housing costs are supply, demand, and restrictive land use regulations. Consider Austin, Texas. Once one of the least affordable cities in Texas, it's seen rents drop for 19 straight months, thanks to a housing boom. Or right next door in Durham, where rents have decreased nearly 12% from last year. The lesson is clear. More housing brings down prices. Across Orange County, however, slow and rigid approval processes that attempt to legislate taste and scrutinize innovation actually increase project costs and delay new construction. Each hurdle, whether a design change or bureaucratic holdup, adds time and expense, reducing the chance for naturally occurring affordable housing to emerge or be preserved. During a recent chamber-led visit to Ann Arbor, Michigan, its city manager offered a powerful insight. Policymakers should be facilitators of results, not gatekeepers of process. That means embracing flexibility in land use rules, trusting streamlined systems, and removing barriers to building. Build and they will come, as the saying goes. Don't build and people will still come, and prices will only rise because supply remains low. A promising bipartisan bill in the state legislature, Allow Housing Near Jobs, SB 499, would allow by right, housing development in commercially zoned areas and allow for converting commercial buildings into residential use. Another bipartisan bill, the Parking Lot Reform and Modernization Act, HB 369, would prohibit parking minimums statewide. This is the kind of forward-thinking policy we need. We rightly focus on helping those with fixed or low incomes, but by restricting supply, we drive up land values, making it harder for everyone, especially lower or middle-income earners, to find attainable housing. Those at the bottom face long waits for limited assistance with limited options, while those at the top face few obstacles, and the middle gets squeezed out. This revaluation should be a wake-up call. Orange County, as a whole, must finally commit to a clear housing strategy that addresses all income levels. We've needed this for decades. It's time to act. As a community, are we willing to accept the restrictive covenants and zoning laws that have squeezed housing availability for generations? Some neighborhoods still have covenants on the books that once barred people of color from home ownership. We must confront the legacy of exclusion and the current policies that perpetuate housing attainment inequity. NIMBYism, N-I-M-B-Y, not in my backyard, protects the property values of some while systemically pricing out others. You may dislike your revaluation, but if you believe you could sell your home for that new value in the current market, then it's correct. That number reflects a market shaped by scarcity, barriers to new development, and a resistance to change. This is not just a local problem. It's a nationwide crisis made worse here by our longstanding habit of prioritizing idyllic notions of the past rather than building for the future. We need massive changes nationwide, statewide, and locally, including reforms to zoning laws, building inspection regimes, process improvements, and greater support for factory-built and component housing that can scale affordability. We need action, not nostalgia. We need the courage to build. Dick?
Thanks, Judith. A tidal wave of change is headed for the U.S. economy. When the COVID pandemic hit, factories in China shut down and global shipping traffic slowed. Within a matter of a few weeks, products began disappearing from U.S. store shelves, and American firms that depend on foreign materials were going out of business. A similar trend is beginning to play out, but this time the catalyst is President Donald Trump's decision to raise tariffs on Chinese imports to a minimum of 145%, an amount so steep that much of the trade between the United States and China has ground to a halt. Fewer massive container ships have been plying the ocean between the Chinese and American ports, and in the coming weeks, far fewer Chinese goods will arrive on American shores. While high tariffs on Chinese products have been in place since early April, the availability of Chinese products and the price that consumers pay for them have not changed that much. But some companies are now starting to raise their prices, and experts say that the effects will become more and more obvious in the coming weeks as a tidal wave of change stemming from canceled orders in Chinese factories works its way around the world to the United States. The number of massive container ships carrying metal boxes of toys, furniture, and other products departing China for the United States plummeted by about one-third in April. The reason consumers have not felt many of the effects yet is that it takes 20 to 40 days for a container ship to travel across the Pacific Ocean. Then it takes another 1 to 10 days for the Chinese goods to make their way by train or truck to various cities around the country, economists at Apollo Global Management wrote in a recent report. That means that the higher tariffs on China that went into effect at the beginning of April are just starting to result in a drop in the number of ships arriving at American ports, a trend that should intensify. By late May or early June, consumers should start to see some empty shelves. Layoffs could also occur for retailers and logistics industries. The major effects on the U.S. economy shutting down trade with China will start to become apparent in the summer of 2025 when the United States might slip into a recession, said Torsten Solk, an economist at Apollo. U.S. consumers will within a few weeks see empty shelves in clothing stores, toy stores, hardware stores, and retail drug stores, and higher prices of the goods that are still on the shelves, he said. Molson Hart, CEO of ViaHart, a toy company, wrote on the social platform X, "It's almost like we're speeding towards a brick wall, but the driver of the car doesn't see it yet. By the time he does, it'll be too late to hit the brakes." The decline in the Chinese imports was amplified Friday when the United States eliminated the so-called de minimis treatment for Chinese goods. That rule had allowed products of up to $800 in value to avoid tariffs as long as they were shipped directly to consumers. It has boosted the business model of companies such as Temu and Shine and has resulted in a surge of individually addressed packages into the United States, many of which are shipped by air. Supporters of the change say that this tariff loophole has given Chinese shippers an unfair advantage and hurt American businesses. But the decision to get rid of it is already resulting in higher prices for U.S. customers. And the change is expected to weigh in on airlines and private carriers like FedEx, which have steady businesses delivering small-dollar goods. Port workers and logistic companies have been expecting their own disruptions. At the Port of Los Angeles, the main entry point for Chinese products arriving in the United States, imports surged in recent months as businesses and consumers tried to stock up on goods in advance of the tariffs coming into effect. But that activity has now started to decline. The number of containers arriving at the Port of Los Angeles is expected to drop more than 35% this coming week, compared to the same week last year, port data shows. Gene Sirocco, the port's executive director, said that a quarter of the ships that had been scheduled for May had canceled because of light volume. As of about 3 weeks ago, goods coming into the port from China have been very few and far between, he said. Data shows that sales of heavy trucks have fallen sharply too, suggesting that companies in the logistics space expect to be moving fewer goods in the future. Trade experts say that companies have stockpiled enough inventory in recent months that if the White House reverses course soon and significantly drops tariffs on China, much of the pain for the U.S. economy and consumers can be avoided. Data from the Institute for Supply Management shows that U.S. inventories are at their highest level in more than 2 years. Gabriel Weidel, a managing director at Tenio, who advises companies on doing business with China, said that the Chinese goods that U.S. retailers had stockpiled in the first 3 months of the year would give stores some time before they would need to raise prices. But if the situation is not changed quickly, American consumers will feel the impact of trade changes unfold over the next 3 to 6 months. We're going to have higher prices and, in some cases, empty shelves, he said. Trump officials have admitted that there could be some disruptions for consumers. The president seemed to acknowledge on Wednesday that his trade changes could lead to fewer goods at higher prices. You know, somebody said, oh, the shelves are going to be open, Trump said from the White House. Well, maybe the children will have two dolls instead of 30 dolls, you know? Or maybe two dolls will cost a couple of bucks more than they would normally. But administration officials have said any pain will be minimal. At a White House briefing Tuesday, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said that he did not expect to see the supply chain shocks from the U.S. tariffs on China. I think retailers have managed their inventory in front of this, he said. Some firms that are more fragile financial positions have not been able to stockpile and are rapidly being forced out of business. Even if the Trump administration finds a way to reduce its tariffs on China, it's not clear that the levies will fall enough to meaningfully restart trade. Many companies say that tariffs above 50% on Chinese imports are enough to stop trade entirely. With tariffs now at a minimum of 145%, and in some cases much higher, that would mean the Trump administration may have to drop its China tariffs by at least 100 percentage points to meaningfully restart the flow of goods. Trump officials have said, that they believe the current tariff rate with China is unsustainable, but they have concerns about Chinese trade practices, and they will be under pressure to show that they have secured significant concessions from China in return for dropping the tariffs. Ryan Peterson, CEO of Flexport, a supply chain company, said that even before the president hiked tariffs on China to 145% in April, the tariffs the administration had put on China were already high at a minimum of 54%. The reality is that 54% was already an incredibly high tariff rate, he said. It depends on how far they walk it back. If they walk it back to 25%, maybe all of this becomes a non-event. With so much unclear about where global trade is headed, companies are freezing their plans for expansion and halting new orders. Data shows that new orders from manufacturers have turned down sharply this year, while companies have trimmed back their plans for capital expenditures. Some companies have stopped issuing guidance for their sales and profits. Mercedes-Benz on Wednesday suspended its financial forecast for 2025, as did Stellantis, which makes Chrysler, Dodge, and Jeep brands. It's not clear how quickly the current supply chain challenges could be resolved. But during the pandemic, supply chain disruptions took much longer to work their way through the economy than forecasters had anticipated. Economists who initially expected price increases to be transitory were surprised at inflationary pressures that lingered for years. Small impacts also had a way of snowballing through supply chains. For example, a disruption in supply from one or two companies making small parts for cars or other machinery could end up stopping a major manufacturing plant, which found that it had no alternative for the part. When the economy turned back on again and the initial pandemic disruptions after those, the process was not smooth. Americans saw pileups at the ports and shortages of some goods, all of which had ultimately contributed to higher prices. Peterson said that companies that operated container ships had already canceled a quarter of all sailings to the United States from China, and they are rerouting their ships to travel to Southeast Asia and Europe instead. Even if the Trump administration removes its China tariffs and U.S. consumer demand for Chinese products resumes, ships will not be able to be in the right location immediately to carry the same volume of goods. You'll see higher prices. You'll see delays, Peterson added. The longer you wait to make the changes, the more severe the shock will be. Judith?
Thank you, Dick. This next article has a headline, Trump says the United States will reopen Alcatraz prison. President Donald Trump on Sunday announced plans to reopen Alcatraz, the notorious prison in San Francisco that housed some of the nation's most infamous and dangerous criminals in the shadow of the Golden Gate Bridge. For too long, America has been plagued by vicious, violent, and repeated criminal offenders, the dregs of society who will never contribute anything other than misery and suffering, Trump posted Sunday on Truth Social. Trump said he directed the Federal Bureau of Prisons, the Justice Department, the FBI, and the Department of Homeland Security to reopen the facility. This broadcast is generously supported by the Orchid Group at Morgan Stanley, and we thank them for their contribution. You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, and we will return to our broadcast shortly.